All right. Hello, everyone. Good to see you. So this is the last concurrent session for Thursday, first day. Well, I guess it's the second day of Sunstone. So welcome. This is session 174, titled Theological Development in Mormon Fundamentalism. And before we begin, just want to make sure you silence or turn off. Look, no one's going to turn them off, but I didn't say that. Silence your phones. And make sure to be respectful to our presenters and other attendees. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they are from you or others. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor to my right. We also hope you are taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books in the hallway behind you. So please continue to support Mormon Studies by supporting these vendors. This is a 90-minute long session, and we ask both the audience and presenters to keep within that framework so we can end on time. Please make sure to pick up your belongings as you leave and look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Each morning, the first 50 attendees get a doorbuster prize, so be here early. So about this presentation, this panel will explore the doctrinal formation in a broader sense, where different fundamentalist ideas come from, how different groups and individuals have interpreted, rejected, or altered doctrine based on their historical understanding, experiences, and beliefs. Our first presenter is Jacob Vedrine. He is a student, independent historian, and researcher. Lindsay Hansen-Park, who is the host of your Polygamy podcast and the executive director of Sunstone Education Foundation. She's currently the co-host of the new Sunstone Mormon History podcast with Brian Buchanan, which I'll give my plug for that. It's fantastic. If you don't subscribe, please do now. And the other ones as well. And Christina Rossetti, who has a PhD in religious studies from the University of California, Riverside. Her research on Mormon fundamentalism and the emergence of new movements within a religious tradition. And if you've heard of The Wave, you probably heard of her, which is awesome too. And so now I'll turn the time over to them for the presentation.
So, can everyone hear me okay? Cool. So, Mormon fundamentalism has a very rich and complex history of where it as a movement derives its doctrinal beliefs. I've come to realize that it's, you know, the more you research it, the more complex it appears. While generally individuals in fundamentalism appeal to authority, the founding prophets of the Restoration, namely Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and John Taylor, their beliefs often are mixed in with what other leaders that besides the prophet and what folk belief in Mormonism was. Because of this, I'm going to use a little dial here to, after discussing different aspects of fundamentalist doctrine, whether it's more rooted in folklore or whether it's authoritative doctrine that was taught by the authorities of the early LDS church. So, the first issue in fundamentalism is plural marriage. Whether it was essential to exaltation or not. Was there a certain number of wives required for exaltation? From Nauvoo, it doesn't seem very clear what was the doctrine. While there are statements such as Benjamin F. Johnson and others remembering that Joseph taught that the parable of the talents was used to teach plural marriage, and it implies that those who do not multiply their talents, as in wives and children, would have them taken from them, there are other statements that suggest that a monogamist coming from the Nauvoo period could still inherit a kingdom or exaltation in celestial glory. As one example of this, William Marks never accepted plural marriage according to any records we have, but he received his second anointing from Joseph Smith. Parley P. Pratt similarly wrote in May 1845, talking about the order of the Ancient of Days being the patriarchal order from Father Adam down to the end of the world. The gradation will descend in regular degrees from the throne of the Ancient of Days with his innumerable subjects, down to the least and last saint of the last days, who may be counted worthy of a throne and scepter, although his kingdom may perhaps only consist of a wife and single child. So Lyman White's colony in Texas similarly held to an understanding that plural marriage was permitted, but not essential to celestial glory. And this is quoting from Polygamy on the Pedernales. John Holly testified further that sealings for time and eternity were performed for monogamous as well as polygamous couples at Zodiac, Texas, by Lyman White. Nevertheless, having more than one concurrent wife, according to Holly, led to the accrual of extra spiritual advantages. Those that were in spiritual marriage were said to be in polygamy, as well as those who were not. The understanding was that they would enjoy the same glory as others, but the ones that had more than one wife would enjoy a greater portion of it. He further offered that it was not necessary and logically sequenced that those who had married for time and eternity would have to practice the doctrine of plural marriage. Yet, if a man took more than one wife, according to Holly's understanding, then his glory, which in eternity would be greater than the husband who had only one wife. So D. Michael Quinn and other scholars have documented that there's a mixed bag of plural marriage statements well into the Utah period throughout Brigham Young's administration. Some statements indicating that plural marriage was necessary for exaltation, others that said that a monogamous sealed would inherit an exaltation. I would argue that fundamentalist ideas about plural marriage being absolutely essential to exaltation are founded in the strong push for plural marriage that occurred during the 1880s, starting with John Taylor's October 12, 1882 revelation, wherein it states, "For it is not meet that men who will not abide my law shall preside over my priesthood." And George Q. Cannon blatantly said that this revelation was clarifying and settling this confusion among Latter-day Saints. In a meeting on October 14, 1882 that Cannon recorded in his journal, "If you notice, reference is made to Brother Senior B. Young. It is said that he shall be placed as one of the presidents of 70 if he will submit and receive the law of God and carry it out. What is meant by that? It means the law of celestial marriage, which Brother Senior B. Young has not up to the present time obeyed. I know there is a difference of opinion among the brethren in regards to this law. Some of the brethren think that when a man takes one wife, that is all that is required of him, unless it comes around without any effort on his part to take another wife. But that law is laid down in this revelation with great plainness, that Brother Senior B. Young cannot be ordained to fill that vacancy unless he expresses a willingness, not only a belief in, but willingness to obey the law which God has revealed and which is binding upon the priesthood in this church." So John Taylor also agreed in the October 1884 conference, quoting from this revelation, saying, "I find some men trying to twist round this principle in any way and every way they can. They want to sneak out of it some way. Now, God doesn't want any sycophancy like that. He expects us to be true to him and the principles he has delivered and to feel as Job did. Though he slay me, yet I will trust him. These are our feelings in relation to this matter. We have been told that it is not meet that men who will not abide my law shall preside over my priesthood. And yet some people would very like much to do it. Well, they cannot do it. If God has introduced something for our glory and exaltation, we are not going to have that kicked over by any improper influence, either inside or outside of the church of the living God. We will stand by the principles of eternal truth. Living, we will proclaim them, and dying, we will be true to them. And after death, we will live again in their enjoyment in the eternal worlds." So, and then 2 years later, John Taylor received the 1886 revelation, wherein he was told that this principle was not to be done away with. And so this is the context that fundamentalists, and not only fundamentalists, but Mormon leaders into the 1890s, and up till about 1904, and you know, the 1900 to 1910, interpreted celestial marriage. But Musser, Joseph Musser, is an early fundamentalist leader. He recorded that Lauren Woolley went a step beyond just teaching that plural marriage is essential. They actually taught to be the head of a dispensation, seven wives are necessary. For the keys of the kingdom, patriarchal order must have five wives. President of the church, three wives. And that's in Musser's Book of Remembrance. This idea appears to be an exaggeration of early Mormon folklore rather than something that was ever taught by the First Presidency. Bishop, and I'm going to quote, for example, Bishop David Evans of Lehigh said, "Some elders are preaching that a man who's not got three wives cannot possibly have an exaltation." And this was in the Salt Lake School of the Prophets in 1870. And he disagreed with this kind of language and You see other statements in the School of the Prophets where others disagreed with it. The closest to the idea that three wives was necessary for exaltation, which appears is statements that it appears to have been suggested by Heber C. Kimball to one of his sons and to Benjamin F. Johnson, but only one time is this ever alleged to be taught by over the pulpit as doctrine. At the April 1884 priesthood conference, an individual alleged that Joseph F. Smith taught that three wives was necessary. There's a letter later that year complaining to President John Taylor that, quote, Joseph F. Smith during last conference told the priesthood meeting that to obey the higher law, they must have at least three living wives at one at the same time. And so, but in contrast to that, Wilford Woodruff denied this necessity, writing in May 22, 1882 to Bishop Samuel A. Woolley, you asked some questions concerning how many living wives a man must have to fulfill the law. When a man, according to the revelation, marries a wife under the holy order which God has revealed, then marries another in the same way, he enters into the new and everlasting covenant. And so far as he is gone, he has obeyed the law. I know of no requirement which makes it necessary for a man to have three living wives at the same time. So because of this these statements and looking at the historical record, I would say that it leans more towards doctrinal, that it was taught in the 1880s that it was necessary for exaltation. I only put it halfway there because before then you kind of have a mixed bag, as George Q. Cannon said. But was three, five, or seven wives required? I would lean more that that's more folklore, because we really don't have any hardcore statements from leaders teaching that. So the next issue in fundamentalism that comes up is priesthood outside of the church. And because fundamentalists were excommunicated from the church, the subject comes up, could they have authority outside of it? And a lot of fundamentalists believe that even though Joseph F. Smith issued the 1904 manifesto and saying that they would excommunicate, cut off from the church individuals who entered into new plural marriages, they felt that this was more of a publicity thing and that it didn't really mean he was sincere against plural marriage. And one statement to use to argue that institutionally the church could be against plural marriage, but that doctrinally it could still be a true principle, a person could look to the diary of William Clayton. And this is a statement in, I believe it was October 17th. I don't have the date on it. It's in October 1843. So William Clayton was recording that he had taken a plural wife and that he was getting advice from Joseph Smith about it. He said that Emma even offered advice about the situation. So he, Joseph, said it was her, Emma's, advice that I should keep Margaret at home, and it was also his counsel. Says he, just keep her at home and brook it, and if they raise trouble about it and bring you before me, I will give you an awful scourging and probably cut you off from the church, and then I will baptize you and set you ahead as good as ever. And so, that's actually October 19th, 1843. So there's two lines of priesthood that come out of the church that claim authority from, that claim that there's special keys and authority beyond the jurisdiction of the church. And the first one comes from John W. Woolley, and the other one comes from Benjamin F. Johnson. And LeBaronites trace their authority from Johnson, and Wooleyites trace their authority from John Woolley. And I would say that even though these groups take these individuals and try to say that they were presided over the priesthood at the time of their death, that historically, I have a hard time seeing that in the historical record for either individual. Even though both individuals did make statements indicating they'd received special teachings and special counsel that allowed them to perpetuate authority independent from the church. And so with Benjamin F. Johnson, in his letter to the first presidency in 1903, he makes a comment alluding, saying, there were, dear brother, other teachings to that council of which I'm not at full liberty to write. But if I had your ear, I would remember that the prophet once said to me, Benjamin, in regards to those things I have taught you privately that are not yet for the public, I give you the right when you are so led to commit them to others, for you will not be led wrong discerning those worthy of your confidence. That was his 1903 letter to George F. Gibbs. Similarly, John Woolley, in a 1914 meeting, is alleged to have said he received direction from John Taylor, that made him support post-manifesto plural marriage. And so, quoting from the minutes, This is Matthias Cowley speaking. He says, "Brother Woolley said to me that he thought it was all right and related to me how President Taylor had spent the whole night at his place and that the president had said in the morning that the principle would not be done away with. And I told Brother Woolley that I could have nothing to do with it." President Francis M. Lyman then said, "Brother Judson Tolman also claims that you sent men to him. Cowley, this I never did. I never sent a man to Brother Tolman." Matthias Cowley, "In answer to Brother Grant, I denied that I ever asked Brother Woolley if he was familiar with the sealing ordinances, or that I told him not to turn a good man down if he came to him. Brother Reuben Miller explained that Brother Woolley had told him how abolishing plural marriage was being agitated by the legal advisors of the church, and how President John Taylor had spent the entire night in pondering over the question, and in the morning came into the room where Brother Woolley was with his face illuminated, and said this principle would not be done away with, but to remain on earth, and that this has strengthened Brother Woolley in believing that the practice should be maintained and had also influenced Brother Miller." And so statements to argue against these men claiming to hold presiding authority. In Benjamin F. Johnson's 1903 Gibbs letter, he still referred to Joseph F. Smith as the prophet Joseph F. Smith, so he wasn't claiming to be over him. And John Woolley similarly had family member recall that he said he would never preside over anyone outside of his own home. So, and that he says people are claiming authority to organize from him, and that he never claimed such authority. So for this one, I would say that both looking at the history of early Mormonism, there is a foundation for there being priesthood outside of the church. That if you look at the August 8th, 1844 meeting where Brigham Young talks about how if the church were to reject the 12, that they would just take their keys of the kingdom as an independent body and go forth and build up the kingdom without, you know, just by themselves. And similarly, in the September 8th, 1844 trial, Heber C. Kimball recalled that he said that Sidney Rigdon had no authority except what he received from the church, implying that there was authority outside of the church. And he went on to say that there was more than 30 men who held higher authority than Sidney Rigdon, referencing this authority outside of the church. And so in that context, I would say that it is leaning more doctrine that there could be priesthood outside of the church. So the proper temple garment is going to be the next subject I discuss, because another one of the key issues fundamentalists took with the church is that they changed the temple garment and they shortened it. And they based this based off of Joseph F. Smith's teachings. I have not seen anything before Joseph F. Smith that references that there needed to be a proper temple garment, and that this, you know, this one-piece jumpsuit had to go to the wrists and ankles. And as an example of this, in Nauvoo, it's referenced that there are garments that are actually two-piece garments in Nauvoo. And another evidence of this is the fact that even though Lyman White's temple clothing was identical to the Utah temple clothing, his garment was different. According to John Hawley, he wrote that it was a loose frock made according to the pattern of the one worn by Moroni when he first appeared to Joseph Smith. And so that's not, obviously, it doesn't have the collar. And he said he also remembered that no marks indicating priesthood were on this garment, which would make sense because Lyman White didn't do signs and tokens in his endowment either. And so his other evidence that there wasn't a proper set garment is Hiram Smith's garment, which was passed down to Eldred Smith, who was the last presiding patriarch of the church. And Fred Collier got to see that garment, and he sketched a rough outline of it in his research journal of this garment top with the different marks on it. And, you know, it had a looser collar, and it clearly was not the one-piece jumpsuit. And then there's this other diagram that lays out kind of the evolution of the garment that was about in the 1840s. They had both styles, both a jumpsuit as well as two-piece garments, but that the two-piece wouldn't be reintroduced among the saints until 1979. So with that, I would rate this as leaning more folklore, that there was a proper temple garment, that it needed to be the one-piece jumpsuit. The other thing I would mention here is that it was in 1893 that they started actually sewing the marks on the garments. Up until that time, they had cut the marks on the garments, and it wasn't sewn on as it is on modern LDS garments, and that they, in the leaders' journals in December of 1894, they discussed this, and that they started selling pre-marked garments. So that's another, so they it's noted that this is the first departure of the Utah Temple garment from the contemporary union suit, which comes in various colors, and which the street garment was based. So the next one was the one mighty and strong, the resurrected Joseph Smith to set the church in order. It's another very popular fundamentalist belief, and they allege that both Brigham Young and that John Taylor taught this doctrine, even though Brigham Young's one of the most well-reported men in the history of the world. We have thousands of pages of his speeches. We don't have any reference to him saying this except for very late recollections alleging that he taught this. What's interesting, though, is George Q. Cannon in his journal in 1886 recalls that Moses Thatcher was teaching this doctrine. And this is from George Q. Cannon's journal, July 19th, 1886, and he talks about how the man raised up will be no other than the prophet Joseph Smith in his resurrected body, and the power to lead Israel in the latter days as Moses led him anciently, having been sealed upon his head as his father Joseph Smith, the patriarch of the church at that time. And so George Q. Cannon quotes from several of Moses Thatcher's discourses, but then comments on it, saying, "I was surprised to hear this, and I thought it would strange that Brother Thatcher should have been preaching in this strain. The instruction that we have received would require him to submit such ideas to the first presidency or the council before teaching them as true. Then they would go out with the endorsement of the man who holds the keys. And if they are not true, the one who entertained them is advised of it, and the people are safe from false doctrine or false views." And so this goes contrary to the idea that Brigham and John Taylor were teaching this, because George Q. Cannon found it strange and that he felt it was a new doctrine. So this one I would also list as being more folklore. It was taught by an apostle, but did not have the endorsement of the Quorum of the Twelve or the First Presidency. So one other big issue that fundamentalists take with the church is the proper wording of ordinations. And they said that you need to say that I confer the Melchizedek priesthood on you for an ordination to be valid. Otherwise, you're just ordaining them to the office, is what early fundamentalists believed. And this issue actually started coming up in the 1880s. And John Taylor has written a letter about it in 1887, where he responded to this letter, basically saying there was not a proper way to ordain. We might answer the question contained in the letter by asking another question. Did the priest after the order of Aaron, who was ordained according to the former by Moroni, on the third chapter of the Book of Mormon, receive the Aaronic priesthood when there was no mention of its bestowal upon him, or anything said concerning him being in the Church of Christ? When a man is ordained to an office and to all the gifts and blessings pertaining to that office, if the man who ordains him has the authority necessary to ordain him, he certainly receives all that is conferred upon him. It is very wrong for elders in this church to be conniving and getting up disputes over such questions, as are mentioned in this letter. Instead of contending upon such a subject, if there be any doubt respecting the sufficiency of the ordination, it would be far better to remove it by giving him another ordination that will leave no room for questions than that to have disputes about its validity. With your kind regards, your brother, John Taylor. And you have Joseph F. Smith, who actually was the one who implemented the policy of saying, I confer upon you the Melchizedek priesthood. He made that be the standard wording of ordination. Yet he himself said that it didn't matter which way the ordination was worded. He said in a 1906 letter, "Of course, all ordinations are not worded alike, and it may be true also that some ordinations may be somewhat defective, grammatically or otherwise, in fully expressing their full scope and meaning. But while it is true, the Lord accepts of the intent. It is otherwise true that officiating elders should learn to express themselves as fully and clearly as possible in ordaining to the priesthood, as well as in the performance of every other duty and labor." And he wrote, He wrote several letters on this subject, and it was Heber J. Grant who decided that because both versions of ordaining were used in the church from the very beginning, that why not switch to the other way, which is less wordy, which doesn't say I'm conferring upon you the priesthood. And so with that, I would say that this one is definitely more folklore, because there are no apostles or leaders teaching that I am aware of. So those are my issues that I talked about. So, thanks.
So when we got together for this panel, we were like, how can we make everybody in the room the most uncomfortable? And Jacob was like, I will take fundamentalist sacred doctrines and call them folklore. And I said, I'll compare the LDS church to the FLDS. And Christina wants to talk about the law of purity. So it's going to be fun for everybody. Really quick before we get started, I like doing this and I get to do this because I'm in charge. How many people here are Mormons but don't follow President Nelson? Just raise your hand. Okay. A bunch of weirdos. Look at all you. Okay, and then how many people have more than 100 cousins? Okay, well, of course. Okay. Yes, no, it's not going to work. Shoot, it's not going to go in. This won't work.
That's the mouse.
Okay, so we're going to see if we can get my documents to, because I have some really cool stuff. I'm not going to actually compare. Yeah, actually. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and talk, and I'll see if you can see what you can do. Will that work? Yeah. Is that one? No, it's not mine. Okay, I'm not going to compare the FLDS and the LDS church completely, so settle down. I'm going to do that later. I've been saving that one up for a long time. But one of my pet peeves when we talk about Mormon fundamentalism is I really resent that... Whenever we're talking about fundamentalism, everybody, fundamentalist, LDS, everybody is like, we can talk about it, but we all need to make sure that we're not the FLDS. It's like, we're good, but we're not Warren Jeffs. That's like what everyone does. And everyone likes to discuss Warren Jeffs as if he's like some distant aberration that just appeared out of nowhere and changed everything. And that's how a lot of people in the community even describe it. They were living, you know, this lifestyle, and they were living this culture, and then all of a sudden the Jeffs come in and sort of destroy it. But while that is true, I want to also add that I believe, and I think that I can prove, that the majority of Warren Jeffs' doctrines, including some of his most extreme doctrines, he found precedent for in Mormon doctrine and theology. And that's an uncomfortable thing. It makes us all uncomfortable because it's a shared heritage and tradition. But I think we should talk about it, not because I want to legitimize his claims, but because I think it's honest. And at the very least, we can use it to be a cautionary tale, showing that Mormon doctrine, as we know, especially in this room, that it can be interpreted in a variety of ways. And there are interpretations of Mormonism that are less charitable. And Warren Jeffs is a good case for that. So, perfect. Okay. So I'm going to just talk about that a little bit, and then we can talk more in the questions. And like I said, I really do at some point want to talk about the similarities with the fundamentalist groups and the LDS, because in the tradition that I was raised in, we are so quick to distance ourselves. Oh, we're not that, we're not that, and we're not that, which is important. We aren't that. I didn't grow up in an arranged marriage, and I wasn't married when I was 12 years old or anything like that. But there are similarities that I think are important, and if we dismiss those, then we are doing, I think, an injustice not only to the historical record, but to our own traditions. So these are some documents that were part of the FBI raid. Oops. Okay. And actually, before I show you that, let me show you. I'm just going to get this picture really quick. Sorry, you guys, it's almost like I'm in charge of a big event. Okay, so this is Naomi, and she is Warren Jeffs' favorite wife. I didn't mean to show you all these photos. You get the gist. That's Naomi. She was captured with Warren Jeffs, and she was one of his scribes. So we actually have a lot of his leaked priesthood records, and this is stuff that would be considered very controversial. This is a revelation. Naomi would often pray with Warren throughout the night, and she would transcribe these doctrines. This is an example. And, you know, I have pages and pages of this. And she would do some of these prayers that are really, you know, we're working with organizations like NAMI who believe that Warren Jeffs was working on a sort of a way to pray where you would disassociate during the prayer. It's really unusual. It's common in victims of trauma. And so Naomi, as she's starting to do these revelations, she would often describe that they would go into these trances. They would be long, long, hour-long things. She talks about Warren's sleep. She talks about what he eats. And just kind of how this process would work. So, and I'm just showing you this, not to pull for them, but I want you just to understand the way that the FLDS were writing down and recording their revelations. So these are some from his morning lessons. And as Warren, later on in his presidency, he would become more and more obsessed with the written word and recording the word. So anyone that grew up in the community that was under Warren Jeffs remembers hours and hours of sermons. They would listen to him for hours and hours. And I would say that is certainly not required. I don't see any precedent for that in Mormon doctrine that you need to sit and listen to the prophet all day long, but that's kind of what happened. So I want to draw that distinction that there are absolutely cultural differences, and I would say that Warren Jeffs is a case for scrupulosity, religiosity on speed. But some of the doctrines that are the most dangerous and pernicious I want to talk about, because everyone likes to talk about the child marriages and the arranged marriages, and those are important, and I don't think that we should dismiss those. They've done tremendous damage to people in the community. But Warren Jeffs had a really pernicious doctrine that people hardly ever talk about, and that's the doctrine of family separations. Is anyone familiar with that? Okay. So what that is Warren, so this actually didn't start with Warren Jeffs. So before Warren, it was Reuelen Jeffs, his father. And then Reuelen, there was Uncle Roy, Leroy Johnson. And Uncle Roy is pretty much considered this beloved leader of the community. In fact, a lot of people who have lost their faith, lost their testimony, don't practice anymore, still have an affection and affinity for Uncle Roy, is what they call him. So Uncle Roy was known to use this doctrine, but very, very rarely. And then Reuelen instituted a little bit more, but as he got older and Warren took over, Warren really instituted family separations. And what this means is basically the majority of faithful practicing FLDS are not with their original spouse, children, or siblings. So Warren has separated families so much. So what would happen was he would bring you in to his office, and he would say, we're accusing you of this crime. So the example of Sarah Allred, I'll use. She was accused of murder. She, in FLDS parlance, that means she had a miscarriage. She did not have a miscarriage. She claims to have never been pregnant. And she had 2 hours to prepare, and she lost her 6 children. They sent her away, and how it works is the majority of people that they send away on repentance missions, they in Sarah's case, it was pretty brutal. They put her in a van. She had 2 hours to say goodbye. She wasn't allowed to hug her children. They were told that their mom is a wicked apostate. She was put in a van, and they drove her, I think it was to South Carolina at a gas station, and just dropped her in the middle of nowhere. And here's a plural wife that has never had any skills, no resources outside the community. And so when I met her, she had a baby. And I was like, wait, you guys aren't supposed to have babies in your church anymore. Like, that doctrine ended a few years ago. And we have found that it's very common that women in these scenarios will, in Sarah's case, she survived by meeting up with a trucker and not knowing anything about the world or birth control or anything, ended up having a baby from that relationship. And that's, I would say that's a pretty common survival tactic for women who've been through this scenario. So she was separated from her children, and it takes people about a year. So what they're supposed to do is work and send money back to the church, write letters of repentance until they can come back and until God forgives them. In her case, because it was murder, it was kind of a death sentence, so there was not a lot of hope. So it took her about a year till she realized that she had some power, and I don't know if Roger Fool is here. Is he in the audience? He's here today. He was her lawyer that helped her get her children back, and I got to witness some of that, and it was really difficult because her children were taught in her absence to hate her, to that they're actually taught that if they don't reject their mom, then any part of their mom that was pure or any part of themselves will also be sent to hell. So it's a really rough transition as she gets back these children. They're, you know, vandalizing her car. They're trying to run away. They're trying to reach out to FLDS. So that's one extreme example. But Warren started really ramping these up. And what would happen was, at first, he would bring you into his office, accuse you of this, he would send you away. And Uncle Rulin, Warren's father, did this more and more and more, and they called these corrections. And it got to the point where, if you talk to FLDS folks who were under this leadership, corrections were just, like, they talk about it very casually. When Warren Joseph was giving corrections. And what that means is every Sunday, Warren would get up at the pulpit and he would issue corrections. And it's basically a picture, this is our congregation, I would say to you, we're issuing you a correction. Peter, you lose your family. Go. And he would get up and leave, and his family would scoot over. And they would reassign them to a new priesthood leader. And this is pretty common. Most people in the town have been affected by this. This doctrine has done tremendous damage. I can't tell you, I don't think that, we don't even have enough resources to contend with the damage. I mean, we're talking about intergenerational trauma. We're talking about family trauma, separation. We're talking about things that we have organizations down there with trained folks, and it's not enough. This is going to be a damage that is going to last for generations that cannot just be fixed. It just does so much damage. However, in my research, when we talk about this and we talk about these like crazy things that Warren Jeffs did, I think that we need to be responsible in making sure that we understand that everything that Warren did, it is my thesis of Warren Jeffs. And this is not shared by some of his stronger critics, but my charitable thesis is that Warren Jeffs had, he was molested himself, he had a lot of demons, he had no resources, he had no language, there was literally no language to talk about sexual molestation or trauma or sexuality or puberty or anything, none, it doesn't exist in FLDS parlance. And so he looked to the only tool to make sense of his own trauma, and that was the scriptures. And so it's my theory that Warren Jeffs used everything, including his own personal demons. He used scriptural reference to both justify, perpetuate, and create doctrine. And I think for us, the reason why that's relevant is because this shows us that scriptures used as a tool to fix everything maybe isn't the wisest thing, right? And so one of the doctrines, family separation, we can trace directly back, and I know that Warren Jeffs cited doctrines by Brigham Young. Now I want you to think and see if you can guess where this doctrine would come from. I'm going to give you a few old source materials, but I will say that Warren Jeffs was a man obsessed, absolutely obsessed with old documents. Anyone close to him or his family or his scribes said that he had an obsession. And in fact, when they raided the FLDS property, they were able to confiscate boxes and boxes, pallets of old books, pallets of old documents. He pored over the pages of the Times and Seasons. There's an apocryphal story of him having dinner with his father when Rulin was still in power, arguing over dinner at Red Lobster. I don't know why you guys fundamentalists like Red Lobster, but it's like every time I talk to you, it's always at a Red Lobster. So he was arguing for blood atonement, that it should be practiced in theory. And the story goes that he was arguing it, and he's pointing the scriptures and arguing it, and finally Rulin pounds the desk and says, "Warren, give it up." And of course, we know that he still carried some of those ideas. But I believe that family separation was derived from the idea that Brigham Young would give wives to higher priesthood. Now, this is something that we have actual records of. It was a belief that Brigham Young taught. One of the most famous is from George D. Watts's observation. We actually have two contemporary sources of this sermon that Brigham Young gave where he talks about, I'm just going to read it. The second way in which a wife can be separated from her husband while he continues to be faithful to his God and his priesthood, I have not yet revealed except to a few persons in this church, and a few have received it from Joseph the prophet as well as myself. If a woman can find a man holding the keys of the priesthood with higher power and authority than her husband, and he is disposed to take her, he can do so. Otherwise, she has got to remain where she is. In neither of these ways of separation, you can discover there is no need for a bill of divorcement. And so I've been researching to find instances where Leroy Johnson did this. My understanding is that Leroy Johnson would take he would find an old frontier doctrine, present it to the group, say, "Hey, what do you think about this?" And there was more common consent. The difference between Warren and Uncle Roy was Warren came in and demanded it, and so he would take doctrines like this and really ramp it up. So the reason why I bring this up is, it's so important that we understand that there is precedent in Mormon doctrine. Warren Jeffs wasn't just inventing this, and there have been arguments, especially in high-profile polygamy cases, that Warren Jeffs is not Mormon, that his doctrine is not Mormon, and it's the furthest thing from Mormonism, and I would argue it's actually fundamentally Mormon. It's just a different interpretation. Another doctrine that I don't have a lot of time. I could do this all day. But there's a doctrine. There are a few rumored controversial doctrines, and one of those is a seed bearer's doctrine. I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty details of that. But basically, there are some really, really pernicious seedy doctrines that involve child brides, underage marriage. Wife trainings is one of the worst doctrines I've ever encountered. Had to get therapy for a long time when I started, when the pages and the when I talked to witnesses and I had to engage in that. This idea that women as young as girls, children as young as 8 years old, were training up until they were 14 to be a wife through sexual practice with ordained elders. Now, it's still controversial. Some people in the FLDS do not believe that this was accurate. But when I started to dig into that, because I wanted to see, is there theological precedent for this? And my understanding, the closest that I can find, because I don't have access to all the sealed priesthood records, but my understanding is that Warren Jeffs took a few quotes from Joseph Smith. And I'm going to read this quote. This is a quote every Mormon knows. In fact, when I was trying to find it, I knew the spirit of the quote, but I couldn't think of the wording. And so I was asking everyone, it was the same thing. You guys all know this. And so I'm going to put it out there before I read it to you, because I'm going to see. Do you guys know that quote? This is what I was telling to people when I was trying to find it. There's this quote that Joseph Smith said something like, if you knew what I knew, like if you knew all the mysteries that I knew, like you wouldn't believe it, right? Everybody knows that. Okay, there's actually three different takes on that. And because I was looking it up, and no one could actually tell me the right parlance, but there's a source from the King Follett Discourse where Joseph Smith says something like, you don't know me, you never will, I don't blame you for not believing my history. Had I not experienced it, I could not believe in myself. And then there is Thomas Bullock's account, and then we have, if I revealed all that has been known to me, scarcely a man on the stand would stay with me. And my understanding was Warren Jeffs started to use these kind of quotes to justify some of the most pernicious things. And I want you to think about the weight of this. And the reason why I say this is because we are all subject to this kind of thinking, this kind of doctrine. When we prioritize quotes taken as first and second accounts of Mormon prophets, and every single tradition does this, we all take a quote. Mormonism is so obsessed with finding a precedent. I always call it, we're all obsessed with restoring the restoration, right? Like if we can trace it back to Joseph Smith, then it's legit. Well, this is what Warren Jeffs is doing. And I think that that's the caution in this argument is you can do that. I mean, you can take a quote like this. Warren Jeffs was able to do that. And in that way, I think it's not very different than what Mormon theologians do. They will parse out and extract from quotes from early church leaders who are dead and gone, living in a different time, and develop a doctrine. And so my argument, and hopefully, like I said, someday I hope to have a very well-articulated argument published so you can read it, is that Warren Jeffs was no different. He was just doing the same thing. The only difference, I think, is that he tended to use doctrine to support his demons, the worst side of his nature, and that is where I think we have Mormon fundamental or FLDS doctrine. And so, that's my argument, and I hope that that's not too offensive, but I think it's accurate that we can't dismiss the FLDS as some aberration. They still have claims to our heritage, to our history. They're clearly pulling from our source material, even if that makes us uncomfortable.
I know a lot of you raised your hand for Lindsay's question, but I follow a priesthood leader named Pope Francis. Maybe you've heard of him. The real priest. No, I'm kidding. Fighting words in this room. So I'm talking about the law of purity, and the reason I got interested in this is I was actually driving out to Solemn Assembly with members of Christ Church, or the branch, and Solemn Assembly is kind of like General Conference, and I was driving out with their missionaries, and they were just talking about their temple, having a great old time, talking about the temple recommend interviews, everything like that. And as they were talking about their temple recommend interviews, they were just rattling off the questions, like normal things like, do you sustain the president of the priesthood? Do you follow the law of chastity? And then all of a sudden, one of them said, do you follow the law of purity? And I was like, that's just some weird way of saying the law of chastity. Okay. And as they're talking, I was like, oh, so do you guys just call it something weird? And they got incredibly uncomfortable. And they were like, well, we can't actually talk to you about this doctrine. So you're going to have to ask someone else, hopefully a lady. And I had no idea what they were talking about until I went to the home I was staying at, and the woman I was staying at was very kind and gracious, and she was making enchiladas, and I pulled up a chair, and I said, can you tell me about the law of purity? And it was so uncomfortable, but she talked to me about it, and so that was the catalyst for this, and so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the law of purity and the doctrine formation about surrounding it, and mainly how Mormon fundamentalism, as Lindsay mentioned, it really draws from historic memory and how fundamentalists know their history really well, and they rely heavily on historic memory, especially of their leaders. If you've ever seen a fundamentalist pamphlet, it's really just quotes from past prophets, because historic memory really matters. But at the same time, a lot of fundamentalist doctrine comes from secular sources, and so in this doctrine, those are specifically medical. So for members of Christ Church or the branch, the law of purity is a doctrine of great importance, and it's related as it's related to living plural marriage. But for groups who do not continue to practice plural marriage, the doctrine, the purity doctrine, or the law of purity may appear as an unfamiliar phrase. Unlike the LDS law of chastity, which defines proper sexual relationships as between spouses in legal and lawful unions, the law of purity goes a step further to define proper sexual relationships within marriage. So that's the difference. The law of chastity is don't have sex outside of marriage. The law of purity is how to have sex inside of marriage and when and how that works. So you can see why this was weird while making enchiladas to bring it up. And I had no idea. Because of its focus on the correct practice of sexuality within marriage, above and beyond sexual practices outside of marriage, it is often referred to as the higher law of chastity by some practitioners in the 20th century. In contemporary discussion, this law is most associated with prohibitions against sexual activity during periods of gestation and lactation. So in a nutshell, the law of purity, while it does discuss things like abortion and birth control, it is most closely associated with a prohibition against sexual activity during gestation and lactation. So Mormon prophets are interested in both the physical and spiritual health of their followers. This is most commonly reflected in teachings such as the Word of Wisdom, which seek to ensure the physical well-being of the body through revelatory teachings on health. In groups where prophets act as both doctors and leaders of the religious community, they become doubly interested in health. And in these instances, regulation on sexuality become more than medical stipulation. They become religious indictment. And one of the interesting things is with the law of purity is most of the leaders who taught this in the 20th century were actually doctors. But they were doctors that relied heavily on past prophets. Most notably was Orson Pratt. So in 1853, Orson Pratt associated sexual purity within the confines of marriage with the well-being of children who were born from these unions. While spirits were deemed innocent and clean from original sin, some church leaders, such as Orson Pratt, taught that children inherited moral qualities from their parents, including at the moment of conception. On the importance of the parent's mental state at the time of conception, Pratt wrote, "The state of the parent's mind at the time of conception and the state of the mother's mind, specifically in pregnancy, will be continuously impressed upon the offspring." Pratt's teaching on the matter was consistent with LDS theology at the time, that spirits are pure when they enter into earthly homes, but they're affected by their environment. And so the state of the environment had to be completely pure. And so there had to be something that made conception perfect in order to ensure that spirits entered into a perfect home. So Pratt was passionate about this subject, but it wasn't until George Buchanan came into the picture and started writing about this that he specifically referenced purity within sexual relationship. These regulations were originally written in the Western Standard, and they are what formally became the Law of Purity. So a lot of people could say that Joseph Smith is the one that came up with the Law of Purity, but it was really George Buchanan quoting what he thought was Joseph Smith. So again, historic memory. So in the newspaper, Cannon wrote on the Utah Territory and the relationship between the spiritual and physical within the embodied human being. As he discussed this correlation, he attributed the health of the parents with the moral state of their surroundings. For Cannon, as with Pratt, impure parents produced impure offsprings, a failing with negative implications for the entire Utah Territory. To remedy this concern, Cannon asserted that, quote, "License to marry should not come from the priest, but from the physician." Even within the religious community, Cannon marked the marital and sexual as an acceptable space where the prophetic and medical could act together to regulate an entire community. For Cannon and Pratt, the moral state of humanity was dependent upon the sexual practices of the married, with particular attention to the health of the procreators, the need to eliminate, quote, illicit intercourse, and the concern for the prolonging of a single stage of a healthy woman. In short, morality depended on sexuality for George Buchanan. And George Buchanan went as far as to say that, quote, "Joseph Smith had penetration enough to know that so long as the bodies of men are weak, degenerate, and tainted with impurities inherited from their fathers for 1,000 generations, it is impossible to accomplish with them any great moral improvement or indoctrinate them with any divine truths." And it's probably fair. So very vague quotes were happening in the 19th century, but a lot of these quotes end up really influencing the 20th century Mormon fundamentalist leaders. And so the most explicit reference to the teachings of the Law of Purity came from a little white book that I was really thankful to Ann Wild, who's here, who actually let me borrow her copy of it. And it's a small white book with interlocking clasped hands on the cover. And the book doesn't list a specific author, but it was published by members of the Apostolic United Brethren in 1974. And like I said, like many books by fundamentalists in the 20th century, it's really just a series of quotes that begin with Joseph Smith and end with Joseph Musser, who I argue, and that's a different conversation, was actually the creator of the Law of Purity. So the first printed reference to the Law of Purity came with Amos Milton Musser, a 19th century leader and early convert to the church who followed Brigham Young across the plains and served in various callings. During his life, he served as church historian and assistant to the church, historian. And he was also called to live plural marriage. So he commented on the Law of Purity, and he specifically references the 19th century and the science behind the law. In his 1877 teaching, Amos Musser stated, quote, "The science of life teaches that during the periods of gestation and lactation, the mother should be free from the too frequent embraces of her husband. It is conceded that this course will promote the growth and development of healthier offspring. Polygamy certainly favors the consummation of this over monogamy." So obviously, in a polygamous union, this makes more sense. So this was a really brief comment. It's one sentence that he said one time in a sermon, and it wasn't until his son, my favorite prophet of the Restoration, Joseph Musser, that we really see this play out. So Joseph Musser's leadership, he was a leader in the fundamentalist movement. A lot of people draw their priesthood from him, especially the AUB, who no longer practice the Law of Purity, but it was a big deal to them for a long time. So the revelation, Joseph Musser claims that he received a revelation in 1936 that harkens back to the 19th century, where he said, "There are great and mighty spirits waiting to come forth when the channel is sufficiently pure to welcome them, but they cannot be born under conditions of lust." And so his biggest concern was how to make sure lust wasn't in marriage. So lust is not just a thing that happens outside of marriage, but he argued that lust could happen within marriage, and that he needed to ensure that that wasn't going to happen. But interestingly, with all Mormon doctrine, is some Mormon doctrines are challenging. And so one of the interesting things with Joseph Musser is he knew that if he taught people the Law of Purity, that they would have to follow it because he was a prophet. And so he actually stopped teaching it to people because he knew that if he taught it to people and then they didn't live it, that he would be walking them into sin. And so he stopped teaching it later in his life. There's actually a few women that through revelation came up to him and said, "I want to learn more about this. Can you teach it to me?" And he was shocked. And he would scribble it on a little piece of paper and slide it across a table to them. And that's how a lot of women received revelation on the Law of Purity. But there was one man who gained a testimony in the practice, and his name was Rulin C. Allred. And Rulin Allred was a homeopathic physician who actually cared for Musser after Musser suffered a stroke in 1949. And Allred became known for his exposition on Mormon doctrines, specifically the higher laws. And one of them that he became known for was the law of purity. And so Rulon Allred would actually preach on any casual Sunday during priesthood meeting on making sure that you're not having sex with your wife during gestation or lactation. And it obviously made people uncomfortable when Rulon would do this. But he became convinced of it, and that is until the end of his life when he too recognized that it was too challenging of a doctrine, and he also stopped teaching it toward the end of his life publicly while still proclaiming it privately. Interestingly, though, one of the biggest proponents of the law of purity was his half-sister, Rhea Allred Kuntz. And she believed not only in the importance of living plural marriage, but she also really devoutly believed in the law of purity. And she actually wrote a book called Polluted Fountains, an LDS look at abortion and other abominations, where she talks about correct sexual practices. She was a very faithful woman generally, but this was a big issue for her. But one of the things that I found particularly important or interesting from her is that she actually didn't draw on many Mormon prophets to make her claim. She actually drew from secular sources on sexuality. And one of the ones that she was really interested in, his name was Walter Siegmeister, and he was an alternative health practitioner and mystic who was a proponent of something called alternative reality culture. This is going to be great. So he also wrote under the name Raymond Bernard, and he believed in a hollow earth. He didn't eat. He was a breatharian, and he also believed really devoutly in what she would call the law of purity. So he wrote a book called The Science. Science Discovers the Physiological Value of Continence, and he wrote pretty extensively on ensuring that people are not having sexual relationships during gestation and lactation. And this is kind of a gross quote, and so just bear with me. So he made a comment that it is maintained on the basis of good physiological evidence that chastity during gestation results in superior brain development. And so he actually believed that the covering of a child when they come out of the womb in a good priesthood home wouldn't have any covering because that was rotting semen. And so that was his medical teaching. And Rhea Kuntz latched onto that. And she believed that that was true based on her priesthood teachings. And then now there's a medical doctor who's arguing this as well. And so this is an example in fundamentalism where secular medical claims will bolster a already dominant religious ideal. So to wrap up, so in the 19th century generally, both physicians and prophets became sources of knowledge in the unseen world. However, in many instances, medical and prophetic came together. Within some contemporary fundamentalist groups, the law of purity remains an ideal. So it's not taught to everyone. That's something really important in fundamentalism, is not all doctrines are taught to everyone. And so the law of purity in certain groups that still considered an ideal, they're not teaching it to everyone. They're teaching it to certain people, especially people who are living plural marriage. So this was the case for the Apostolic United Brethren, who discontinued teaching the law of purity widely following the death of Rulon C. Allred. So from my research with the law of purity, it is my belief that there's actually only one group that is currently practicing it, and that is Christ Church, or the branch. And I was really fortunate to get to talk to their late prophet before he died, and he had great stories of his father storming into AUB priesthood meetings and proclaiming that we need to be teaching this more and we need to be talking about sexuality, and Rulon Allred would be like, no. And so it's my belief that only one group is currently practicing the law of purity, but that in itself is an interesting reflection on how fundamentalist doctrine works and how not all fundamentalists practice fundamentalist doctrine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Lindsay, Christina, and Jacob. So now we have about just under 30 minutes for Q&A. Should I put this up there so people come up? Do you want that there? So we'll put the mic up here so you can come to the mic, you can form a line to ask questions. And just make sure, like all times, to not give an epistle so everyone can ask questions. That'd be great.
A question for Jason. Pardon me?
Jacob.
Oh, Jacob, my apologies. From what I've read about that period between 1890 and 1904, there were men who were set apart to perform plural marriages without reporting anything back to the top leadership. Therefore, President Woodruff and others could deny that they knew nothing about continuing plural marriages. So whether it's folklore or doctrine, I think there's another aspect to that situation. It would be administrative practices and actions that were taken by various church leaders to continue the practice of plural marriage, but allow them to deny its continuation. Comment on that, if you would.
Okay. I see that in my research as well. I would add that that's, you know, because there is that plausible deniability where they aren't really wanting to keep a tight control on it, that's where certain leaders argue that that was what, you know, Joseph F. Smith was continuing to want to have happen after 1904. And I've been told that in Matthias Cowley's diary, he writes about how he's had certain conversations with Joseph F. Smith, but that he was getting frustrated because certain, you know, they're starting to come down on polygamists, and so he was concerned that he was denying that, you know, not remembering these conversations had occurred. So that is definitely plays into, you know, the formation of early fundamentalism. So, yep.
My question's for Lindsay. I see some, in part of what you said, it makes me think about, even in the scriptures, it talks about not wresting these scriptures to your own condemnation. You're talking a lot about how all of these doctrines, even the most insidious ones, essentially are Mormon in the core, at their core. And I wonder if you have anything to say about what makes it healthy and what makes it unhealthy. Essentially, can you give any advice as to what kinds of traditional views lead to these heinous outcomes versus good outcomes?
That's a question for a prophet, not for me. I've been thinking a lot about what Taylor Petrie, who is here, said this morning in the opening plenary when he was talking about modernity versus fundamentalism, and we're talking about fundamentalism beyond the scope of what we mean for the groups that are here today. Just this idea of how people interpret scripture and doctrine, and he cited the study, I don't know how many people heard it, but it was where he played audio and asked people what they heard from it, right? And I guess a pop culture reference to sum up his thing is it's that dress that went around on Facebook, is it blue or brown or whatever, right? How two people with the same experience and same moment of time can have completely different things taken away from that. And I've been thinking a lot about that as it relates to this, because this is an idea that I'm always kicking around because I interact with so many different Mormon groups. And one of the things that I think that humanity is not very good at, that we're getting better at, but we're not very good at, is to understand where we position in things. And so this is a very loaded word. I don't like using this word because it's become stigmatized, but a sort of liberal rhetoric, but the word privilege, right? We have these discussions of privilege. And it's used around, and people don't like talking about it, but I really like privilege theory, and let me tell you why. Because I think privilege theory is a useful tool to help us see where we situate in a larger society. If we can look at it like that, it's just an instructive tool. It doesn't mean that your life is better than someone else's or whatever. It just shows, here's the map of how people are interacting, this is where you fit, this is the barriers that you face, blah, 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 blah. I don't think that religion or personal revelation or prophetic revelation really accounts for this. It's sort of a one-size-fits-all formula. And then you're supposed to derive the personal revelation. And that's where we get into trouble with Mormonism. I think this is why we have so many extant groups. We have so many different interpretations, and there's something really beautiful about being able to do that. So I'm not arguing for this like authoritative top-down argument, because I think we have plenty of cases where that doesn't go well. Although, if we leave everyone to their own devices and give them these life-changing document or revelations and then say, you know, any woman over a certain age is worthy or whatever, then we have people talking about consecrating their daughters who are underage children. And that certainly isn't great either. And I have talked to fundamentalists who practiced what I consider to be shameful, despicable practices, and they will tell you very forthright that, just because society doesn't agree with it doesn't mean that it's not good. So society thinks a lot of things are bad. And when you have that kind of thinking, you can justify literally anything. And I think, unfortunately for all of us, Mormonism has a lot of flexibility to do that. So I can only go by my ethical rubric, and my ethical rubric would be the thing that gives people the most autonomy and connects them most directly with God without an intermediary. Is something that I personally subscribe to. I think that, you know, this is something offensive for this group, and I hope you don't take it as a slight on you. This is my own personal belief. Priesthoods and authority and all this argument is so boring to me, and maybe it's because I'm a woman and it's never really applied to me, and I'm like, I don't need you guys. Jesus and I have a phone call line, and I don't need to talk to you about this. But it took me a long time to learn that, and through a lot of shame and a lot of, I would say, risky and negative behavior that I don't think that is godly or of God. And unfortunately, I see that. I think it's pervasive in Mormonism. I think we idolize our prophets. I think we idolize the words of our prophets. We idolize documentary history. We worship it. And there's some responsibility in that, but we're not balancing it with context or accountability. And the idea that it's not complete. And so that doesn't answer your question, because I don't know how to answer your question. I think the best thing I can do is argue for the most education, autonomy, and resources of people.
I was just curious about the sequence of the words Mormon fundamentalist versus fundamentalist Mormon, and I'd heard that some prefer to be referred to the latter rather than the former. I wonder if you could address that.
I haven't heard any fundamentalists. I've heard that, I know people who are identified as fundamentalists don't, there's some of them who don't like the term because of derogatory comments or, you know, history, connotation with the word. But I haven't heard anyone specifically debate about whether it should be a fundamentalist Mormon or a Mormon fundamentalist. So
I would say the majority of the debate that I witness comes from LDS people who are trying to boundary maintenance who gets to use the term Mormon. But is Anne here? Anne and I are going to be in a panel, and we're going to talk a little bit about this term later on, because, and Anne, if you want to answer that question, she has a whole packet that can talk to you about this term, Mormon. But I would say that the majority of Mormon fundamentalists that I know care way more about authority and their prophet than they do what Mormons, like, here's the thing. LDS people especially, we think we're, like, really important and everyone cares about us. Everyone cares about us except for Mormon fundamentalists. They don't care about us at all.
In a loving way.
Last year, I got to go to the LDS Church's Christmas party, which was a weird invitation. I was talking to Sister Bingham, who's the General Relief Society president, and she asked me what I did, and I said I study Mormon fundamentalism. And her husband was sitting there, and he was like, "What's a Mormon fundamentalist?" And she, I know. He didn't know. And she was like, "They're the ones that do the polygamy, honey." And he was like, "And they call themselves Mormon fundamentalists?" And she, in the most perfect way, she was like, "That's what we call them." And I was like, "Oh." And we remember, it's true. That's what Boyd K. Packer is the one that coined Mormon fundamentalism. And so that's very much an LDS designation. And so I actually really like that fundamentalists have claimed it, because it did start as a derogatory, and now they're like, "This is what we are," and I love it.
I just want to say one thing, and I'll talk about this on the panel, but my favorite thing about all y'all is that we'll get together and it'll be like, "Who's the real Mormons?" And everyone's like, "We are." It's like, "But I'm the biggest group, LDS, so we're the real Mormons," and people will be like, "I'm the smallest group, so we're the real Mormons," and it's like, "You guys are, we're all the same."
I'd like to address what you said and what you didn't say.
Okay.
I guess I might as well start with you.
Great. Go for it.
You should have mentioned in your speech that the Old Testament was against having marital sex during a period.
Yeah.
And for a week after. And my take on that is that 1 week after is the most perfect time to get pregnant.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things is actually, and I talked to members of Christ Church about this, because members of Christ Church are really interested in Jewish family law. And when I initially asked some members of Christ Church about the law of purity, I was actually directed to a Jewish family law website that explained Jewish family law. But interestingly, Joseph Musser never said a single thing about menstruation, ever.
Myself, I don't hold with that idea. And I wrote a poem about it once.
I know. It's in the my article.
Oh, okay. Well, in any case.
But we'd love for you to share it with the audience if you would like to, oh, Fred.
Okay. There was an old man who lived in a shoe. He had so many wives that he didn't know what to do. So he taught them all the law of purity and rolled over and went to sleep. And I would like to comment on some of the things you quoted from Joseph Smith. Like, no man knows my history. If I was to teach what everyone, what I know, not a man on this stand would stay with me. And other similar statements. You can take those statements, they're out of context. You need to know the context. I mean, of course, anybody can do that with the Bible. They can take things out of historic context and make things out of Scripture that aren't there. Like, for example, it says in one place in the Bible, and Judas went out and hanged himself. And in another place, it says, go thou and do likewise. And so you can do that with history. It cannot possibly be complete. To be complete, you'd have to have an infinite history on every movement of every human and every person, every living thing, every rock, every atom. Such history is not perfect. Thank God for the documentary history. It was kind of written as a wartime history. Didn't get into a lot of things for self-preservation purposes. But now when you want to talk about what Joseph Smith, well, what is it? Look at it, what he taught. That God is a man, that he has a body, that there's more than one God, that God is married, that we have a mother in heaven, that eternal marriage is true, that plural marriage is true. And those kinds of things were all secret. Look what happened to the church when those who broke their covenants began to discuss the plurality of gods. It was quite an excitement. I'm really glad it happened, because we wouldn't have the King Follett sermon, and we wouldn't have had the speech that followed it in 11 days before the Masons murdered the prophet. But in any case, I'm glad for those things. But that doesn't justify all this crazy crap that you allude to. And I don't care what people who want to make of it, okay? You quoted a speech that I got out of the archives back in 1973. It was never published, and I got it out and published it in 1978. It was October 8th, 1861 conference address on divorce. And the context of that can't hardly be compared to what Warren Jeffs began to do. And what he could make out of an isolated statement, I take it from that speech that if a woman was unhappy and she wanted out of a marriage, and she had good reason, she could go up in the priesthood, but not down, or not marry out of the church.
And I think that that's the tension that proves my thesis, right? We have this text, and we're talking about this context, but even the things that you stated, you said the prophet is this, the prophet said this, the prophet said this. My experience with I have not interacted with, you know, Steve Shields' 487 extant expressions of Mormonism, but I've several hundred probably talked to, we could get them all in a room and they would argue based on the text. Because Mormonism re-reared the text. So if we're going to sit down, everyone is going to go back to the text as authority. And if the text fails us, then we go to personal revelation.
Yeah, but in context.
Of course.
You know, interestingly enough, Joseph got a revelation that a history should be kept. And there's more history on Mormonism than any other church that ever existed on earth.
It's because Mormons are crazy and we like our genealogy. So yeah, so that I would just say that that backs up the thesis. I think that everybody wants to take the context and say this is what the history says. And of course, you're known for having very careful theology, very precise theology. I would not say that Warren was known for the same thing, but I would say that the process is similar. He goes to old textual evidence and he tries to, you know, make sense of it in the modern context.
So I have a proposal, and I'd be interested to have your commentary on this. My world's just collided. I was raised Catholic. As a freshman at BYU, I read all of unpublished Revelations, and so this is kind of interesting to me. But if we re-democratized Mormonism, so there's this concept of common consent. So when Brigham Young, for example, was vying for leadership, he went to the people, and they had to vote him in. And that's, you know, there was some tension there. That's why we call it a crisis. What if potentially, instead of going to a leader or a quote for doctrine or folklore, those things were presented to the people, and there was truly a ratifying vote, you know, whatever context you find yourself in, where the people kind of had the authority in determining that. Do you think you could ever see that happening?
So there are two examples that I have witnessed, and one is Community of Christ, who, this is a recent example, but they take the practice of by common consent. Community of Christ is an old RLDS, and they call themselves a prophetic people. So the idea is that revelation comes through the body of the people, and then the prophet's job is just to basically put a stamp on it. I'm being reductive, but that's kind of the gist. So the idea is there's, like, in popular culture and society, we're discussing LGBT issues, and so that becomes an issue that the church discusses. And over a period of time, they've come up with a consensus model through trial and error, and they would say very grave error. Their consensus model wasn't always this equitable, but they have, like, a voting system, and people vote 1-7, I think, on how comfortable they are on certain issues or something like that. So they've been working on this issue. The other would say be the remnant movement, the modern snuffer movement, which it's very grassroots, the fellowships are very autonomous in the sense that they don't, it's not top-down. But I worry, based on what I've seen, that some of the problems that we face in, like, the corporate LDS church are unavoidable. But that's just my theory.
I'm Catholic. That sounds like a mess.
I don't think that question addressed me. So.
Thank you all for such great papers. My question is for Christina about the law of purity. I'm curious. I think you have a really compelling argument for the genealogy of these practices in 19th century medical science. But I'm curious, maybe this will be a little bit of speculation on your part, but you seem to offer two different arguments for why it isn't practiced in some communities. One, that they didn't want to talk about it for whatever reason, including that they thought that it would bring condemnation on the people. And I forget what the other one is now. But I'm curious if the change of scientific arguments in the 20th century, in late 19th and early 20th centuries, that said that these are incorrect assumptions, influenced the abandonment at all, if there's any sort of feedback about the drawing on science as a way of speaking against the law of purity.
Yeah. So even when, like, Siegmeister was talking, like, we already knew that Vernix wasn't semen. Like, we knew that already. And that didn't stop members of the Apostolic United Brethren from thinking that, you know, modern medical science is wrong and Siegmeister is correct. I do think that the law of purity was abandoned because of it being hard. I do. I think that's why most movements who at one time did practice it but no longer do. I do think the idea of condemnation was the major part of it, only because all the leaders that at one time did teach it and then taper off, they very verbally said that they're no longer teaching it because it's too hard and it's going to cause condemnation. The other thing is,
in a lot of fundamentalist movements, not just Mormon fundamentalism. Sex education is something that is lacking, and people aren't teaching sex education. And so to teach the law of purity, it is a step further in sex education than most parents are going anyway. And the law of purity for a long time was on the heads of the women to teach their daughters and on the priesthood to teach their sons. And that's not something that fundamentalist movements do. And so I do think the law of purity is an interesting case study for a doctrine that does have historic precedent that was just abandoned, and to be able to consider the reasons for that. But I think it was because it is a condemning practice.
Okay, so my questions may be more for Christina and Lindsay. I'm sorry, it was Jacob, right? I don't know your relationship with fundamentalism, so I'm not going to like project anything here, but if you want to answer, answer. So Lindsay, you brought up this idea of privilege and how you're situated in the world and how you receive information. In philosophy or epistemology, we talk about that being situated knowledge. Wherever you're situated in the community is going to affect the way you have biases, the way you interpret these things and how you interact with these things. So my question is, with situated knowledge, neither one of you are fundamentalists or ever been fundamentalists, but you feel really comfortable telling the fundamentalist story. So in the situated knowledge, I mean, we have that with people of color and with the queer community. Who gets to tell whose story, and why are you qualified to tell the story? Second question, if it's because, I know I'm being really hard on you, I'm sorry. If it's like, hey, I'm an academic and I'm doing this from an academic perspective, okay, again, what gives you the quality as the academic to come in and treat someone's lived experience like an academic exercise?
First of all,
Don't let her in next time.
I don't know where she came from. I don't know who invited her here. Listen. First of all, I'm a busybody. I never claimed to not be, okay? I'm also a Mormon woman, and I get in people's business. I have terrible boundaries, so sorry about that in advance. No, I feel like I approach the subject as an LDS woman. I feel like I speak to an LDS audience. This is a mixed group of different traditions, and I think I'm comfortable in the way that I speak to the topic because there is a translation process that I didn't understand when I first engaged in this. In fact, I went in very naively and I would say ignorantly and offensively with this idea of like, hey guys, LDS Church, we're better than everyone else. And I have really come to sort of resent that impulse in myself. And so when I try to talk to it, I'm always approaching it from an LDS lens and how we can approach the doctrine. And I get criticism because people think that I'm sometimes too soft on Warren Jeffs, and because of course his doctrine is pernicious, and I don't think you need to be an outsider or an insider to state that. I mean, historical record, he's a criminal. I've listened to the tapes, so I'm very comfortable with that condemnation. But what I'm not comfortable doing is pushing them to the fringes of outside of our experience, because even though I am an outsider to their particular tradition and doctrine and leadership, I don't think that I'm completely a foreign outsider, and that's the way that I've approached it. I am not, I started activism as a white woman in Utah helping women in the Congo, and then I realized like I had no business being there. I'd never been there. I didn't know these people. It's a very sort of white savior approach, and so I wanted to work in the own corner of my world. And so this is a corner of my world. And because of that, I'm interacting with groups. And I think it's important to understand this, understand that I'm not speaking for fundamentalism. And that's the other really complicated thing that I try to be really responsible about is FLDS. When I talk about that to most people, they're like, oh, Warren Jeffs. And they think all fundamentalists are Warren Jeffs or, you know, wearing prairie dresses. And that's what I think that I bring to this conversation is sort of complicating that conversation. And that's really my agenda.
So I'm going to answer your question with a weird story. From Sunstone 2018, Lindsay brought a priest to Sunstone, and she was really excited about it. A priest, the Catholic priest. Oh. Lindsay brought a Catholic priest to Sunstone, and she was really excited, and she was like, Christina, I brought a Catholic priest. And she introduced me, and I looked at Lindsay after that, and I was like, he's not a real priest, because he was part of the ecumenical Catholic Church, not the Roman Catholic Church. And I know. Yeah. And I was like, he's not a real Catholic priest. And in that moment, I had to really think about what I meant by that. And the reality is, I'm a traditionalist Catholic. Like, we don't call our fundamentalists fundamentalists, we call them traditionalists. And traditionalist Catholics, they wear the veil and they kneel for communion, and I'm one of those people. And I know.
I'm a recovering Catholic. So.
Yeah, I'm a fundy Catholic. And so Mormon fundamentalism was a safe way for me to consider who I was. Because it's really hard to look at your own faith tradition and have to dig deep into it and make sense of it and figure out who you are. And so Mormon fundamentalism gave me a way to do that. And academically, I got into more interested in Mormonism because I read Rough Stone Rolling, and I met LDS people, and I was like, are they really Mormon? Because they don't look like this book I'm reading. And so Mormon fundamentalism, I became interested in Mormon fundamentalism, and I've been very honest about that. It was a way for me to understand myself, but it was also a way for me to unpack all the weird authenticity claims that came with my reading Mormon history, and then showing up in Utah at a ward in Provo and being like, "This is what, where is the polygamy and the consecration, and why is Adam not God anymore?"
You want to take it?
This will be our final question. After you answer.
Oh, I was just going to
start answering then.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say that I'm the shallow guy who's just looking at it from an academic perspective. So,
be honest. Well, Christina, here I thought you were Catholic.
I am.
That's a little joke there.
Oh.
Obviously, not a good joke in this company. Blair is a tough act to follow, but no, based on my admittedly fairly superficial knowledge of this subject, it doesn't seem to me that the Woolies left the 1886 revelatory experience with John Taylor with the intention of starting a new religious movement. So I guess this question is for you. How did it happen that those movements became separate? I think that's the link that I missed in your presentation, was that experience to the beginning of distinct and separate churches or organizations, as opposed to an underground movement, which is, it seems to me, which is what President Taylor intended.
Well, it's definitely messy, and it's not black and white, because it's kind of a gradual thing where these people still consider themselves part of the LDS Church, and many fundamentalists to this day still consider themselves part of the LDS Church, just not a part of the corporate body. And so it was something that was gradual and shifted and developed over time, and you kind of do have this proto-fundamentalist phase between, you know, 1900 and 1920, where there are people who have these ideas, but they aren't yet forming meetings, they aren't yet organizing. And really, it was Lauren Woolley who really started ordaining men and into a council of friends and started a real movement of it that was really a distinct priesthood hierarchy. So, yeah.
Woolley instructed people not to form groups, not to hold meetings. That was their original injunction from the very beginning of fundamentalism. Stay in the church, go to the temple. But everybody got cut off.
Well, thank you all for coming. Before you leave, we could thank Lindsay, Christina, and Jacob.
No. Yeah, that's a pretty diverse little panel.